Hi, I'm Vicki, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Vicki.
I want to, first of all, thank Bonnie for inviting me to speak here. Both my parents are in recovery, and I believe that they spoke at this event the first time that you had it back in 1990. And we call this the Turlock effect, when the Al-Anon speaker comes up to speak and all the AAs jet out the door. Just so you know, it doesn't only happen in Turlock. I'm going to tell you my story. I always feel like I should sing, here's my story, it's sad but true. I was raised in an alcoholic home. My father was the alcoholic, and my mother was the severely untreated Al-Anon in the family. And for those of you who have grown up in an alcoholic home, or who were the adults in the alcoholic home, you know the insanity that goes on for the children. Growing up in my home, everything was really high or really low. And so you didn't get any attention if everything was just okay. And so in our family, we kids learned that if we wanted some attention, we had to do something really bad, and then we could get some attention. Or we could be the shining star. But even as a shining star, you didn't really get a lot of attention. Really, if you did stuff really bad, that's when you got the attention. There was 8 kids in my family. I have 5 sisters and 2 brothers. And I'm 3rd from the bottom on that. And from a very early age, I was the very happy child. Now, I need to tell you, there's 2 families that came together. My father had 5 daughters when he married my mother. My mother had myself and my brother. The reason that my father had custody of his 5 girls that many years ago, and I won't tell you how many that was, the reason he had custody of his 5 little girls is because his first wife had committed suicide. When his first wife committed suicide, his oldest daughter was 10, and his youngest daughter was 6 months old. And so when my mother and my father came together, I was 2 years old, and one of the things that I understood right up front was that I was different. What I knew was that these 5 girls carried a sadness with them that I would never understand. We didn't talk about the suicide. We didn't talk about their mother. We did not talk about my mother's first husband, although I found out later that my mother's first husband was a physically abusive psychotic, was what he was diagnosed. Which I think is the same as a San Bernardino cop. And so that was the crazy household that I was thrown into when I was 2 years old. And I was a very happy child growing up in Berkeley, and I was the singer and the dancer, and I was going to be a star from the time I came out of the womb. And when they got married and suddenly I was surrounded with all this sadness, the message that my mother gave to me almost every day was, don't be happy, because when you're happy, it hurts your sisters. And when I started going to school, and I was very successful in school, in grade school, I came home, I had been elected class president of 4th grade, which was incredibly important at the time, and I came home to let my mother know that I'd been elected class president, and what she said was, shh, don't talk about it, it just hurts your sisters. So this is kind of the home that I grew up with. My father was also a periodic drunk, which means that we never knew if this was a drunk week or a sober week. I learned not to bring friends home to our house because I didn't know which day this was. I didn't know if it was a drunk day or a sober day. Just because my father hadn't drunk in 3 or 4 weeks didn't mean that this was not going to be a drunk day. We never knew when it was coming. So as a result of that, I spent most of my time at other people's houses. As much of my time as I possibly could, I spent at other people's houses. Now, I was a really good kid, and then I hit junior high school. And for some reason, my father's drinking had gotten worse, the kids were older at home, and the teenage insanity was starting, or had been going on for several years, but I was just now aware of it. And things got really, really ugly in our home by the time I hit junior high school. And one of the things that I decided was that being a good kid wasn't getting me anywhere, and so I was going to be a bad kid. And so in junior high school, I started hanging with the stoners. That kind of tells you what era I was raised in. And I started running with the bad kids. By the time I was a freshman in high school, I was cutting school every day. My freshman year of high school, I actually attended like 23 days of school. Needless to say, I flunked my freshman year of high school. My sophomore year of high school wasn't any better, and the insanity at home was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I told you that it wasn't okay to be good in our house, and that if you wanted attention, you did something large. And it seemed for a while there that the phrase of the day in our house was, "Oh, Mom, I'm pregnant." That's just kind of how us girls walked through it. And by the time I was finishing my junior year of high school, I had decided that I couldn't live in this crazy place anymore. I knew that my father was a drunk, and I couldn't stand the man. I just thought my mother was a complete idiot for staying there. And so what I did is that in my junior year of high school, when it was done, I decided that I was going to run away from home. And by this time, my oldest sister was living in Murdoch, Nebraska. Now, this whole time at school, I'm in San Jose, California, and she was living in Murdoch, Nebraska. So I ran away to Murdoch, Nebraska. I don't recommend it, but it's what I did. I decided that I was going to attend my senior year of high school in Murdoch. Now, my graduating class in San Jose would have been roughly 500-600 kids. I get to Murdoch, Nebraska, and it's my senior class in Murdoch, Nebraska is 18 kids. And if I thought I felt like an oddball at home, I felt like a total oddball at this school. My senior year of high school, there just really was nothing to do in Murdoch, Nebraska, if you can imagine such a thing. There was football. There was football players. So I joined the pep squad, did the star football player, got straight A's, and graduated 5 months pregnant. I did everything there was to do in Murdoch, Nebraska. But it was really interesting because it had taken me so long to find a niche and to be accepted into this little small town. And when I finally snagged the star football player, I became a part of the town. Suddenly, I was popular. Suddenly, people liked me. I was being invited to parties. I was one of. And when I found out that I was pregnant, I knew that I would be tossed out completely. But what ended up happening is that we ended up getting married the day after graduation, and then all the little old ladies from town got together and they gave me a baby shower. And I was so touched by that, because in my mind I had just done the one thing that my parents had been throwing kids out of the house for a long time. And they weren't throwing me out. This town was not throwing me out. They were keeping me. And so I ended up married to this man, and we had a wonderful relationship for about a week and a half. And then I found out that he was physically abusive. And him being physically abusive was not something that I could admit to immediately. It took me 2 years in recovery before I could admit that I had been physically abused. Because the only thing that I knew about my mother's first husband was that he was physically abusive. And when I left home, there was one person I vowed I would never be in my life, and that was my mother. I didn't care if I turned out to be my dad. He was the one everybody loved. But I was not going to be my mother. And here I was in this physically abusive marriage, and I thought that I was just like her. I ended up, after 2 years, I finally left that marriage. So my son and I left that marriage. I got a job. I started working for this little electronics company. And at this electronics company, there was a whole group of people there that had fun. They were having fun every night. You know, they'd come back the next day to work and they'd be telling all these stories about how much fun they had the night before. And they were over at the bar. They would go over drinking at the bar all night long, and then they'd come in the next morning and be telling all these great stories. Now, that sounded like fun to me. But sign me up. I'll go. So I started going to the bar every night. And what happened for me was that I was living in a different state than my family. I had been very lonely my entire childhood. I had been very lonely in my marriage. And being alone was the last thing that I could tolerate anymore. And so I started going to this bar every night, and I fit in with these people. Because I know how to do drunks. I've been doing drunks my whole life. I knew how to do that. And so I would go with these people over to the bar at night. And, you know, unfortunately what I found out was that I don't drink very well. And I have to tell you, my very first experience with alcohol, I was 14 years old, And a group of friends and I, we went to the rock quarry in San Jose that doesn't exist anymore. We went over to the rock quarry. We all had a little six-pack of Stubby beers, of course Stubbies, because we were cool. And we sat down in this rock quarry and we drank our Coors Stubbies. And I started puking. I mean, I was just puking my little guts out. And one of the guys that was there decided to walk me home. And as we're walking home, I'm pulling off into the bushes every once in a while just puking my guts out. And I'm leaning in the bush and I'm throwing up and I feel his hand on my shoulder and I look up and here's this 19-year-old boy whose face is silhouetted by the moon behind his head. And I thought, wow, this stuff works. And I remembered that when I was hanging out in those bars. What I remembered was that, you know what? When I drink like them, someone goes home with me. I like this. And so what I found out was that if you drank the first beer the same way that they did, they didn't count after that. A little self-obsessive, but not a lot. And so what I did is I would take the first beer and I would down it and I'd slam it down on the table and say, yeah, I'll have another one. And now I was a part of. And it didn't matter whether I ever had another one after that. I had the first one the same way that they did. And for the next 2 years, I spent my life doing that. I spent my life making sure that I did not go home alone. And what that meant is that my son got left at babysitters. It meant that my son got left wherever I had dropped him off on my way into work. That's where he stayed until I picked him up. And sometimes that was that same night, but most of the time it was a week later. I was so afraid to be alone that I would go home with anybody that would take me. And I didn't care if that was your brother, your husband, your father, your son, as long as I didn't have to go home alone. I was petrified. But I knew how to work it. And I ended up losing my job at the electronics company, and so I started tending bar. Made sense to me. Figured as long as I was there all the time, I might as well be making money at it. And one of the greatest things about tending bar for me was that then I didn't have to drink. If I was serving them their alcohol, I'd still get to be a part of, and I didn't have to drink. Now, if there's any alcoholics left in the room, you're looking at me going, okay, she's whack. But that was the truth for me. Alcohol never worked for me except to get the man. That's what alcohol did for me. This went on for 2 years. And at one point, I got a letter from my sister who said, Dad's sober in California. And I thought, so? She says, no, you're going to love him. You got to come home. He's so great. You're just going to love him. And I thought, I'm sorry. I will never like the man. He's a drunk. He's mean. I don't want to have anything to do with him. And I don't care if he's sober or not. But you know what? I ended up burning every bridge that there was to burn. By this time, I was in Lincoln, Nebraska, a little bit bigger town, although not much. And I was just burning bridges left and right. Women wouldn't talk to me. A lot of the men were in trouble because of me. It was not a good thing. And I had babysitters that would no longer take my son. Pretty small town. They all knew that if they had him in the morning, they would probably have him for a week, and they didn't want to play that game anymore. And I was sitting in an apartment that I was borrowing from someone because God knows I couldn't afford my own. And I was sitting in this apartment, and I came to is the only way that I can explain it. And for those of you who remember doodle art posters, when I came to, I was coloring this doodle art poster, and I looked at that doodle art poster, and I realized I was using all these morbid colors. It was all dark reds and blacks and dark, dark greens and dark, just dark, very morbid. And when I looked at that doodle art poster, I was very scared. Because what I remembered was that for the last 3 days, I had been planning my own suicide. And by planning my own suicide, I mean that I was making sure that the house was clean that I was staying in. I made sure that all my bills were paid. And I made sure that my son was with his grandparents because I knew that they would take care of him. And it was a matter of fact that I was going to take me out. And that scared me. And so I picked up the phone and I called my mother in California and asked if I could move back to California. And of course she said, absolutely. So I packed my son and myself up and we moved back to California. Now fortunately my parents were on vacation when we got to their house. Because when I walk into their house, I might as well have been walking into a complete stranger's house. This was nothing like the house that I grew up in. It was very tidy. There was no Jim Beam up on top of the refrigerator. There was no spilled rocks glasses in the middle of the living room. There was no man passed out in the chair over there. And it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before. And my son and I had an opportunity to be in that house for about a week before my parents came back from their vacation. When they came back from their vacation, they walked through the front door, and I just looked at them. And they had the same faces as the people that raised me, but I had no clue who those two people were. Absolutely no clue. They were talking with each other. Now, my parents never fought the whole time I was growing up, but that's because they never spoke to each other. And here they were coming through the door, and they were talking with each other. And they were laughing with each other, not at each other, which I found very odd. And it was very bizarre. And for the next couple of months, I stayed in their house, and that was the most bizarre thing of all. Now, my father never talked on the telephone the whole time I was growing up. He was just mean. He didn't like people. He didn't talk to people. And my mother certainly didn't talk on the telephone when we were growing up, because people could overhear your conversations. So I'm in this house for a couple of months, and my dad is on the phone probably 8 hours a day for long periods of time, like an hour at a time. And I hear him saying weird stuff, like God. And I hear him saying weird stuff like, go to a meeting, say the serenity prayer. And I'm thinking, who is this Fruit Loop? This is, you know, I don't know who you are. Aliens came in and took over your bodies. I don't know who you are. And I stayed in that house for a couple of months like that. And every once in a while they go, so good, what's your drinking like? And I'm like, we're not talking about that, so it's fine. Eventually, I got myself a job there in California, and you know what? There was a group of people there that had a bar that they went to every night, and I went, oh, I know how to do that, and so I started the routine over again. So here I am. I'm living in my parents' house. My parents have sobriety and Al-Anon recovery in their house, and I'm back to my same old tricks, if you will. I met a man in a bar one night. And he asked me to marry him that night, and I did say no. And about a week later, my secretary came to me at work in tears, and she said, you have got to talk to this guy. He has called 14 times a day for a week, and he won't take no for an answer. You have got to talk to him. And I thought, okay. So he called again. I took the phone call. He said, will you marry me? I said, could we maybe do lunch first? Now, you'd think I'd know maybe there was a little bit of problem, because he was telling all of his friends that he had met this beautiful woman in a black dress. Now, I don't own a black dress, so I'm not really sure who he met, but he was pretty convinced it was me. So we went to lunch, and he asked me to marry him again, and I did say no again, because we maybe do dinner. So we did dinner, and he asked me to marry him again, and I said, well, maybe I'll just move in. So I moved in. It made perfect sense to me. Besides, I could get out of that crazy house where they're talking weird languages. So my son and I move in with this man. Now, this man had everything that I could ask for. He had a house. He had a job. He had two kids. What else could I ask for? And he drank like a loon. I know how to do drunks. And so while we were living together, we went to a concert in Sacramento, and he and his friend in a blackout left me and my girlfriend at the concert. And I was furious. I ended up overnight in Sacramento with no money, no car, no nothing. And when I finally got a hold of him, he was at our house going, and I was in trouble, which to this day I don't really understand. But I was so angry at him. I was so furious with him. And the thought that went through my head is, if I could hate somebody this much, I must really love him. So we got married. Made perfect sense at the time. So now we're married. But we're doing the Dottie and Don domestic thing. We're mowing lawns. We're, you know, polishing furniture. We got the kids running around. And we're just having a great time. And every weekend, we have a party. Every weekend, there's a bunch of people that come to our house, starting on Friday night, and they leave somewhere Sunday afternoon. And that's what we do. That's our life. It's so wonderful. We go to work Monday through Friday. We come home. We party for the weekend. And then we start all over again. Well, pretty soon, weekends started on Thursday. Because what the heck? You know, they're going to be here anyway. We might as well start on Thursday. And then weekends started on Wednesday. And then I'm not really sure when it happened. But at some point, there was no such thing as a weekend. It was just forever. Everybody was just there. And my husband discovered cocaine. I could kill the person who introduced him to cocaine. He discovered cocaine, and he became a dealer, which is not a really good idea when you enjoy using it as much as he did. I thought that dealers, like, made money. We did not. And the party just went forever. And one of the things that happened with our kids is that our whole life revolves around drugs and alcohol. Our whole life. And all three of our kids knew how to roll a joint by the time they were 10. They helped us with the triple beam scale. They folded bindles for us. And they helped us cut the coke. That was our life. And if our kids wanted to participate in our life, that's what they had to do. And there were several times as the progression started that I thought, I cannot do this. I don't want to raise our kids this way. I don't want to do this anymore. And I would tell him, we've got to stop. We can't keep living like this. And he would tell me, you had nothing when you got here. You'll have nothing when you leave. And it would hit that place in me that was so afraid to be alone. And he would tell me, if you don't drink and use with me, I'll find somebody else that will. And that scared the crap out of me, because I knew he would. And I was so afraid to be alone that I would keep sticking around, and I would stick around, and I would drink and use with him, and I would weigh the coke out with him, and I would go to the store and buy the beer, and I would do whatever it took for him not to throw me out of his house, because I knew that he would do that. And there were some horrible, horrible, horrible things that went on. And just to give you an idea of how bad it was in our house, we are the dealer. We throw a New Year's Eve party, and nobody shows up. Not a single person showed up. That's how bad it was in our house. And our kids were screwed up. I mean, they were now in their teenage years, and they were doing their own drugs and alcohol. And my husband decided that, gosh, I might as well make sure that they're getting clean stuff. And so my husband started supplying the drugs for the kids. And that pretty much threw me over the edge. I couldn't deal with that. And I cried a lot. I cried a lot during this time. And at one point, now my mom and dad live about a mile and a half from my house at this time. And I would just go loopy. And I would call my mom up. She'd say, well, why don't you come on over? And I'd go sit with my mom and talk. And she'd go, well, do you think he's an alcoholic? And I'm like, no. No, absolutely not. She goes, well, do you want to go to an Al-Anon? No Al-Anon meeting. I don't need that. It's been great for you, but thanks, but no thanks. And eventually one day she asked me, do you want to go to an Al-Anon meeting? And I said, yes. And so she took me to an Al-Anon meeting one night, and I walked into the room, and they had the steps and the traditions hanging on the back of the wall. And I looked at that first step, and I was flooded with relief. Because it said that he was powerless over alcohol and that his life had become unmanageable. I had found the solution. And so I went home from that meeting and I let him know that he was powerless over alcohol and that his life had become unmanageable. Wasn't that wonderful news? And he was not the least bit impressed. In fact, I think he nodded at me while he was popping a beer and But that was enough ammunition to keep me living in that house for another 6 months, because I knew that it was his problem. He was powerless over alcohol, and his life had become unmanageable. Oh, sheesh, finally, freedom. It's not me that's crazy. It's him. But about 6 months later, I'd be worn down. I had heard it way too many times. There were affairs that went on. There was people in my house all the time. There was just stuff going on, and it was crazy. And I'd wear down about 6 months, and I'd go to my mom, and I'd whine and snivel, and she'd say, let's go to an Al-Anon meeting, and I'd read that stuff again. Oh, yeah, he's powerless. He's powerless over alcohol, and his life's become unmanageable. Okay. And so I would go home again, and I did that every 6 months for 6 years. For 6 years, I read that step as it applied to him. And finally, one day, I was lying in our bedroom. I was on the floor in the fetal position, and I had been lying on the floor crying for several hours. My children had come to me and tried desperately to appease me, to calm me down, and there was just nothing that could be done. And while I was laying on that floor, I realized that I was stark raving mad. I knew that if anybody could get into my head in that moment, that they would know that I was crazy, and they would lock me up in a heartbeat. I knew that. And as I was laying there, I knew that this insanity had to stop. It had to stop. We could not keep doing this to ourselves and to our children. And so I got up off the floor, and I walked to the closet, and I pulled down a gun. Because my only solution to end the insanity was that somebody had to die. It was the only solution that I could see. And so I walked to the closet, I pulled down the gun, and as I was walking to the other closet to get the bullets to load the gun, it occurred to me I didn't know who to kill, him or me. And so I went to the phone and I called my mother. Now, I did not ask her which one to kill. What I did ask her was, I said, Mom, what meetings do you go to? And she told me, and I said, good, I'm going to go to different ones. Because what I knew in that moment is that every time I had gone to a meeting with her, I did it to make her proud of me. I read that step as it applied to him because I could not let her know that I might have a problem. I had to look good no matter what, and I knew that if my mother was in the room, I would not be honest. And so I went to my first meeting on May 10th, 1988, for me. And I went to the newcomers meeting, and I stood there, and I cried. I cannot tell you who was in that room. I cannot tell you the words that were spoken because I have absolutely no clue. But I sat in that room and I cried. And it was the first time I had ever let anyone outside of my children see how broken I was. And I cried in that meeting and said nothing. And when the regular meeting started, I continued to cry. And for the first time in my life, I knew that I belonged somewhere. Nobody said that I belonged there that I heard, but I knew that I belonged there. I knew that there was nobody in that room that was judging me. I had been to enough Al-Anon meetings to hear that somewhere in the periphery of my mind, and I knew that nobody was judging me in that room. I knew that I belonged there, broken and ugly, and that nobody was going to throw me out no matter what I did. I had been to enough AA meetings with my dad, and I had heard over and over again that half measures availed us nothing. And in my first Al-Anon meeting for me, I made the commitment to myself that I would not do half measures, that I could no longer afford to look good no matter what. I was dying. I was crazy. And someone had to stop the insanity. And if that meant me, I was willing to do it. And I started going to meetings every day since then. I have been an active member of Al-Anon. I heard, you know, read the literature, come to meetings, get a sponsor, do the steps. So, in true fashion, I went to meetings, I listened, and I did the steps. And when I got to step four, I realized that I needed a sponsor. Because, of course, I was still doing selective listening. And there was a meeting in town that asked people to stand up if they were willing to be your temporary sponsor. And so I made a point of going to that meeting. And I sat in the very back row. And when they asked for people to stand up who were willing to be a temporary sponsor, everybody stood up. And I went, oh, I like the back of her head. And so I went up to her after the meeting and asked if she'd be my sponsor. And she said, well, yeah, let's get together and we can start working step one. Well, I've already worked 1, 2, and 3, and I'm ready to start working 4. So, you know, and she goes, okay. well, let's get together on Tuesday night and, you know, we can look at step one. No. I've already worked one, two, and three. And I'm ready to start four. And she goes, okay, well, let's get together on Tuesday night and we'll start with the first half of step one. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And I understood at that point that she was not going to let me off the hook. And so we did get together. And the way that this woman had me work the steps was just incredibly awesome. And what she had me do was that in step one, we worked the first half of step one. I was powerless over alcohol. She made me for a whole week carry a notepad. She made me write down everything that I ran across that I was powerless over. Everything. The red light. The girl in front of me at the grocery store with 14 items in the 10 item or less line. You know, things that it never occurred to me that I was powerless over. Did you know that I was powerless over my teenagers? I'm sorry. That doesn't work. But I was. I was powerless over what my teenagers thought. I was powerless over what my teenagers were doing. And those are the kinds of things that I did. And then for the second week, she told me to write down every time I tried to control something over which I had no power, my life became unmanageable. What an awakening. What an awakening. Here's these teenagers that I am trying desperately to shove into this little box of how they should act and how they should talk and what they should look like, and our lives are unmanageable. Because I was trying to control them and I was powerless. In the second step, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And she said, in order to come to believe, you've got to see evidence. And so for a week, she had me carry around this notebook and she said, gather evidence of God. Every time you see evidence of God, I want you to write it down on a piece of paper. And that's what I did. And I remember thinking, okay, coincidences. Because there's a logical explanation for everything, you know. And God knows I'm the queen of logic at this point. And so I started writing down evidences of God. And I remember sitting in my living room at one time. And I am totally anal about where I put my car keys. My car keys are always in the exact same place, always. I do not lose my car keys. Except on this one day. On this one day, I'm trying to go to work. And I cannot find my car keys anywhere. And I'm pissed. I am ripping cushions apart. I am digging. My purse has been emptied four or five times on the middle of the floor. I'm ripping through my house trying to find my car keys. And finally, I was angry, and I just said, okay, God, deal with it. I can't find these car keys. Where are they? And I sat down on the couch right on my car keys. And I went, oh, well, there's an evidence. Okay. And again, you know, I just got to see unfold. You know, here I was trying to control something over which I had no power. My life became unmanageable. And the minute I let it go, God provided for me. And I was breathing again. And it was wonderful. And in the third step, what she had me do is that she had me take the third step prayer out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she asked me to take that prayer and break it down into seven different sentences. And she says, I don't care how that breaks down, because it breaks down different for everybody. But I want you to write one line on a yellow sticky, and then the second line on a different yellow sticky, and the third line on a different yellow sticky. And then on Monday, I want you to carry sticky number one with you all day long. I want you to put it on your steering wheel while you're driving. I want you to put it on your computer terminal when you're at work. I want you to put it on your bathroom mirror when you're brushing your teeth. And I want you to find out what God tells you is the meaning of that prayer. And I did that for a week, and my eyes were completely opened. I understood that prayer as it applied to me. Not how it applied to you. Not your relationship with the God of your understanding. But I learned what it meant to me in the relationship that I had with the God of my understanding. And when I was done with that, she asked me to go do a formal third step prayer, me and God. And I was able to do that third step prayer with a complete understanding of what that meant between me and my God. And when I had to do a four-step inventory, I balked. You know, I balked for a long time. And I was talking to a girlfriend of mine who was in recovery, and she said, what's your problem? You were there. And I thought, oh yeah, I was, huh? And so for me, the way I ended up doing my inventory was I actually wrote my life story. And what I found out was what she had said was true. I had been physically there for my entire life, but I had not been emotionally present for most of it. And during the process of writing my inventory, I became emotionally present to my own life. And in the fifth step, when I shared that with my sponsor, I was so afraid to share so many things that were in there because I wasn't going to look good. And when I got done reading my inventory to my sponsor, she walked over and hugged me. And I thought, wow, this is what they talk about when they talk about unconditional love. And I had that experience from her. And by having that experience from her, I was able to trust that maybe God was even more capable of that than she was. And I launched on the rest of my recovery. Now, she told me after I did my fifth step to go write a six-step list, go write down all the character defects that I had discovered inside of that inventory. And so I did. She said, and when you're ready, then you can humbly ask God to remove them. So I went, I left that fifth step meeting, and I wrote all my character defects, and I went, yeah, you can have them. And, you know, put the notebook away. But someone had told me that once you've done your seventh step, you could date. Did you know that? Sounded good to me. Because by this time, the one who said, if you don't drink and use with me, I'll find somebody who does, he did. He found somebody else that would drink and use with him. And so I was on my own, and I had finished my seventh step, and so now I could start dating. Lucky me. Lucky somebody else. This will be fun. So I found the boy with whom I wanted to go on a date. I painted the target on his chest. I watched him everywhere he went. I knew what meetings he went to. I knew when he went to those meetings. And I knew that I was going to have that boy. Because not everything had changed in my life yet. So sure enough, he asked me out. And we started dating. And very serious relationship for all of 6 weeks, I think. And at about 6 weeks into it, I was in so much pain in this relationship. It was horrible. I was in so much pain I couldn't say. I was in so much pain that I was willing to write about it. And so I went home and I pulled out my notebook and I blew the dust off of the cover, and there, the last thing I had written were all my character defects. And I went, oh, gosh, I just lived out every single one of those in this relationship. And it was at that moment that I could humbly ask God to remove them. I thought I had done a seventh step, but I hadn't even come close. My experience was that God had to show them to me. God had to show me how those character defects were still affecting my life before I could let them go. And that was my experience with that. And then it was time for an eight-step list. Now, I don't know about you, but my eight-step list was about 5-6 pages long. Because in my mind, everybody I had ever met since the time I was 2 needed to be on my eight-step list. And so I went to my sponsor and I brought her my eight-step list, and she laughed and she said, Vicki, did you know that second graders just do that? I thought, oh, so I don't have to make an amends to that girl in second grade? She said, no. But what she made me do was go sit in a park. She made me go sit in a park and watch children. Because I had no concept. I was an adult from the time I was 2 years old in my head. And adults don't behave the same way that a 2-year-old does. And yet I was doing 2-year-old things. And so I went to go sit in a park, and I was looking at watching these little kids play. And I thought, why would I expect that 7-year-old to know any different? And that was part of the amends for me. I got to forgive myself for a lot of the things that I had done that I thought a 7-year-old should know better. Because you know what, in my house, that's what we heard all day long. You know better. I didn't. I was 7. I didn't know any better. And so those were the kinds of amends. I actually had 3 amends lists when I got done with my sponsor. I had the list that was, yeah, no problem. I had the list that was, if I have to. And then I had the list that was NFW. And there were 2 people on my NSW list. One was my father, and one was my second husband. Now keep in mind that my father, by this time, was, I'm looking at the NFW list and I'm freaking out, because it's like, that's of course all I can see is the NFW list. And my sponsor's like, okay, you know, there's several people on those other lists that you can take care of now. Let's not worry about the NFW list. And I'm like, oh, okay. And my ex-husband called and he said, I need to come by and get the barbecue. And I thought, okay. And then my son said, Mom, can you run me over to the school? So I ran him over to the school, and on my way back to the house, I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to be alone at my house with my ex-husband who's on my NSW list. Oh, God, is this it? Do I have to make my amends? And I pulled up to the house, and the gate was open. And in the 2 minutes it took me to run my son to school, my ex-husband had been to the house, gotten the barbecue, loaded it up, and gone already. And the message that I got from God was, Vicki, I will take care of you. When it's time for the amends, you'll know it. You'll be given the opportunity and the information. And it was probably about 6 years later that my stepchildren came to me to let me know that their father was dying in the hospital. The doctors had said this was it. And I knew that I had not made my amends to him and that I needed to do that. And so what I did is that at the time I was sponsoring a dual member. And anyone who's a dual member, the difference between Al-Anon amends and AA amends, in Al-Anon, we're very gentle. We're very loving. And I knew if I told this AA member that I had an amends that I hadn't made yet and he was dying, that there would be no gentle. There would be, okay, honey, do you want to? It would be, get your butt in the car, we're going to the hospital. And so when she knocked on the door, I told her. I said, my ex-husband's dying. I haven't made amends to him yet. And she said, get your butt in the car. We're going. So we drove to the hospital, and we walked into his hospital room. And he was hooked up to all kinds of things. He was very yellow. His belly was completely distended. And he looked horrible, and he was in a lot of pain. And when I walked into that room, I knew he was dying from the disease of alcoholism. And it was the first time in all my recovery that I understood that this was a disease. That he didn't wake up one morning and say, oh, please pick me. That he didn't do anything at me, to me, that he did what he needed to do in his disease. And it took him out. Normal drinkers don't die the way that he died. And I understood in that moment, and I had compassion, and I had love, and all of the resentments that I had carried with me for years and years and years were melted away. And I was able to make my amends to him, and he died 2 days later. And I'll forever be grateful for the dual members that I sponsor, because they teach me another dimension of this program, and it's a dimension that I need. My ex-husband, my second husband, was the other NFW. No, that was that's the one that died. Never mind. It's my father. See, I don't even want to talk about him now. I was sitting in an Al-Anon meeting, and some guy came through the back door. He started ranting and raving about how we didn't know what we were doing. How could you call yourself an Al-Anon meeting? You guys don't have a clue. You're doing it all wrong. He was just screaming and yelling at us. And while he was screaming and yelling, I went 5 years old, man. I just shrunk into my chair. And I thought, man, I got to get out of here. And so I handed my basket money to the girl next to me, and I left the meeting. And I never leave a meeting early. But I knew I had to get out of that meeting, and I left. And I'm in my car, and I'm just crying. And I don't know why this man has upset me so much, but he has horribly upset me. Crying, and I'm shaking, and I'm driving. And I'm thinking, man, I got to get home. I got to call my sponsor. I got to call my sponsor and find out what's going on. And I'm driving. I got to call my sponsor. I got to call my sponsor. And I get to my driveway, and I got to go see my dad. And I went, what? I got to go see my dad? But I listened. I listened to the message, and I drove past my driveway, and I pulled into my folks' driveway. And I walked in the front door, and my mother immediately stood up. And I said, Mom, I'm not here to see you. I'm here to see Dad. And my dad stood up out of his chair, and he walked over, and he hugged me. And we stood in the middle of the living room, and we just cried. I just cried in his arms. And what I got, the message that God gave to me, was that I had deemed my father alcoholic and totally incapable of loving. I had deemed my father idiot. I had deemed my father mean, nasty, and vile. And even in his sobriety, I could not take him out of that box. And I had never allowed him to love me. And I told him that. I said, Dad, I've never allowed you to love me. I deemed you alcoholic and incapable. And I want to change that. And he just hugged me and he said, Vic, I've always loved you. I said, well, I'd like to start letting you. And from that day to this, we've begun the process of building a relationship together. I can't say that immediately, just because I said I'm ready, just because I said I'm willing, we did not immediately have a relationship. It has taken years and years for us to get that. 10th step, on a daily basis. On a daily basis, I have to look at my day. And I have to make amends where they're necessary. And I hate making amends, so trust me, I keep it as clean as I can. And then the 11th step, start through prayer and meditation. Prayer is talking, meditation is listening. Listening is not something I've done very well my whole life. But today in Al-Anon, I've learned how to listen. And that's what I do today. And it's for the knowledge of His will, not mine, and the power to carry that out. And there's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that talks about that upon awakening, we ask God to direct our thinking. And the message that God gave to me was, Vicki, you asked me to direct your thinking. Now you have to walk as though you believe I am. And that's my responsibility. See, my whole life I had been praying to God and saying, God, if you do this, and God, if you do that. See, I had a 7-Eleven God. I had a God that was open late, last resort, prices were really high. You know, that was the God I came in here with. And what God said to me was that if you ask me to take over your will in your life, now you have to walk as though you believe I have. If you ask me to direct your thinking, you have to walk as though you believe I am. And therefore, your thoughts are my thoughts. Your truths are my truths. Walk with them. And that's how I have to live my life today. In the 12th step, it says that we had a spiritual awakening. My spiritual awakening has been huge. I feel like the lion was woken up, you know, and I am loving life right now. I do service. I do a lot of service. I sponsor a lot of women, and then I also do service beyond the group level. I am involved in service. And I wish I could say that I'm involved in service because I want to carry on this program. Let me tell you why I'm involved in service. I'm involved in service because I know that will get me to show up every day. That's why I'm involved in service. I know that if I don't have a commitment to this program, that it is way easier for me to watch American Idol. You know, I can find any. I would start watching Survivor if it were up to me. But I have commitments in this program, and it's commitments in this program that get me to keep coming back, because I don't have the self-motivation to do that on my own. I don't have the ability to look at me and go, woo, Vic, you're pretty whack today. Looks like you need a meeting. I'll leave that to my kids. But what I know is that I can't do that. And so what I had to do was that I had to sign up for service, and I'm involved in service so that I keep coming back. And what a wonderful gift that is, that by me doing something selfish, I'm giving back. And that's the way God's world works. I told you a little bit about my family, and I just want to close with this one story. My mother died 3.5 years ago. This is a family. My father was an alcoholic. I hated him. My mother was an idiot as far as I was concerned for staying with him. There was two families brought together, and we didn't have much in common. And there was a lot of separation in our family. And what happened 3.5 years ago was that my parents went to vacation in Wyoming. And while they were in Wyoming, my father called me at 5 o'clock in the morning in California and said, Vic, your mom's in the ambulance. They're taking her to the hospital. I don't think she's going to make it. And I said, Dad, do you want me to fly out there? And he said, I don't know if there's enough time, but go ahead and book a flight. Gather all your sisters at your house, and we'll say goodbyes over the phone. And so I gathered all my sisters at my house. Actually, there was two houses, my house and then my other sister's house up north. And I have Sam, another sister and a brother that live in Wyoming, and they were there at the hospital. My mother went into a coma, and my older sister, who was there in Wyoming, let each of us kids get on the telephone and say our goodbyes to our mother. And so my sister sat there and held the phone to my mother's ear while we said our goodbyes to her. And my brother and I were the only two that were able to fly out to Wyoming. And so we got in an airplane and we went there. And we didn't know if we were going to be there in time or not. But we'd said our goodbyes on the phone and we were okay with that. And so we flew out to Wyoming. And as soon as we hit the ground, we came into the airport and my niece and my nephew were standing there going, run, run. So we start running to the car. And my niece starts telling me that whenever my mother's breathing would slip, and it would start getting very jagged, my dad would say, your babies are on their way. Hang on. Your babies are on their way. And their breathing would pick back up again. And so when my brother and I got to the hospital, my sister was standing in the parking lot. Run! Run! And so we ran into the hospital room. And I got to say goodbye to my mother. And I got to take her little face and I just got to look at her. And I got to tell her how much I loved her. And I got to say goodbye. And my brother got to say his goodbyes. And as the nurse came in and asked if they could unplug my mother, and I looked at my dad, and my dad said, okay, it's time to let her go. And so my dad stood on one side of my mom, and I stood on this side, and he and I held hands on my mother's forehead. And my one brother was here, a sister there, and a brother there, and we wrung around the bed, and we were holding hands. And I looked up at this sight, and I thought, this is a family that didn't talk to each other, that abused each other, that hated each other. And because of the miracles of 12 steps that came into our lives through Bill and Bob many, many years ago, because my father was willing to listen to the message that was given to him in Alcoholics Anonymous, and because my mother was willing to listen to the message that came to her in Al-Anon, that we were a family. And we stood there and we loved each other and we let my mother go lovingly. And I looked past the ring of people that were around my mother, and I had nieces and nephews that were in the room. And what I realized was that they were getting to watch the miracle of recovery. They were watching us lovingly let go of someone who meant so much to us. And they would learn the lesson of love in that room and in letting people go. I will forever be grateful to these programs. I thank you for inviting me. Thanks.